Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Anti-Muslim hate crimes primarily are aimed at provoking and hurting Muslim communities. In recent years, Western regimes not only refuse to criminalize Islamophobic acts, but also authorize them and provided protection. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote in this regard, "The brazen desecration of Islamic sanctities in the name of freedom of expression and thought has been scandalously normalized in Western societies. More recently, we witnessed in Stockholm and The Hague this issue where the Noble Quran was desecrated in broad daylight. And as always, Western countries not only remained mute spectators but became cheerleaders for it. On January 23rd, Edwin Weegslaved, a far-right Dutch politician and a provocateur and leader of the Islamophobic group Pegida, tore pages from the Quran in The Hague, the administrative capital of the Netherlands. 2 days earlier, in another provocative act, far-right politician Rasmus Paludan, a dual Swedish-Danish national, known for his anti-Islam extremism, burned a copy of the Noble Quran outside the Turkish embassy in Stockholm under police protection and with permission from the authorities. A week later, Paludan repeated the act, setting ablaze a copy of the revered Islamic book outside a mosque in Denmark again under the police cover. Naturally, these acts triggered anger, outrage, and condemnation worldwide, in particular from Muslim-majority countries. Despite the legitimate demand for legal action against such provocations that hurt the sentiments of 1.4 billion Muslims across the world, Western regimes did nothing except for issuing face-saving statements. Their inaction and indifference came under the garb of the freedom of speech and expression, which gives them a license to brazenly insult and abuse Islam and Muslims and conveniently get away with it. Anti-Muslim hate crimes primarily are aimed at provoking and hurting Muslim communities. In recent cases, the Western regimes in question not only refused to criminalize these acts, but also authorized them and provided protection. Western media also kept mum except for reporting on reactions from the Muslim world. Their coverage was mainly focused on how this incident would potentially impact Sweden's ambitious bid for NATO membership. This indicates how Islamic religious values are compromised in rapidly secularizing Western societies. Interestingly, some Western countries have blasphemy legislations that are designed to protect religious beliefs and prevent violation of those beliefs. Blasphemy is defined as the act of speaking in a way that shows irreverence for God or sacred sanctities. In some European countries, it is a punishable crime. Punishment ranges from fines to prison sentences. However, in 2017, Denmark repealed its blasphemy law, and the last Swedish laws against blasphemy were annulled in the 70s. It was replaced by a new law called agitation against a specific group of people, which does not protect religions but their practitioners. The Netherlands, France, Greece, England, Wales, Iceland, Ireland, Norway, and Scotland are also among the countries that repealed the law. Some other European countries, like Germany, are also contemplating taking a similar step. In fact, even in countries where the law is enacted, it does not necessarily extend to all insults against religions and the desecration of the Noble Quran. Unfortunately, decriminalizing such hate crimes and continued disregard for insults against Islam and desecration of its sanctities, ostensibly to defend freedom of expression, is bound to result in Islamophobia and Islamophobia-linked crimes and even killings. In July 2021, the National Council of Canadian Muslims, NCCM, announced that Canada has seen more mass killings motivated by Islamophobia in the last 5 years than any other country in the group of seven G7. In January 2017, the Quebec City mosque shooting left 6 worshippers dead and 19 injured. It was one of the deadliest mass murders in Canadian history. In August 2022, a string of killings of Muslim men in New Mexico in the U.S. state of New Mexico sent shockwaves through Muslim communities across the country. By the same standard, cartoonists, editors, and publishers of the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, who have made a habit of mocking Islamic figures and sanctities, should also be detained and put trial. But unfortunately, prejudice against Muslims has been essentially normalized, and Western double standards in this regard are only fueling the flames of Islamophobia.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
France is in a crisis mode. Police have clashed with protesters angry at President Macron's controversial pension reforms. Unions claim 3.5 million people turned out across the country, while authorities suggested the figure was much lower at just under 1.1 million. In the capital, Paris, union leaders said that a record 800,000 people took part in the march throughout the city to demand that the government drop the fiercely contested change. Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said dozens of police officers had been injured and dozens of people were arrested across the country. Earlier, workers blocked access to a terminal at the Charles de Gaulle airport, forcing some travelers to get there on foot. French trade unions have called for fresh nationwide strikes and protests amid growing anger over the government's unpopular pension reforms. Trade unions have blamed the government for, quote, the explosive situation in the country. They also asked workers to continue protesting against President Emmanuel Macron's pension reforms.
For us, 10, 12 years ago, the previous pension reform was already unacceptable. What we want is a retirement age at 60 years old and 55 years old for those with hard-working conditions. And at one point, all these demands have to be expressed on the ground. And if we have to go beyond the demands set by the inter-unions, then this is what we will do.
Train and air travel was disrupted, while teachers were among many professions to walk off the job. Plumes of smoke were seen rising from burning piles of debris, blocking traffic on a highway near Toulouse in southwestern France. And strikes briefly blocked roads in other cities as well. Police also fired tear gas at some protesters in several other cities, and used water cannon against others in Rennes in the northwest. Protests against the measures have raged since January.
The only thing he could say to appease the younger would be that he renounces reform, that there won't be any reform, that he respects the fact that the vast majority of the people don't want it, and that he regrets the way it happened. It most probably won't be that way, so I think we are in a deep crisis that will linger on for weeks and maybe months.
The French President Emmanuel Macron has said the legislation, which his government pushed through the French Parliament without a vote last week, would come into force by year-end, despite escalating tensions. The protests are the most serious challenge to Macron since the Yellow Vest revolt 4 years ago.
We may be at the beginning of a new Gilets Jaunes, Yellow Vest movement, absolutely, because there is no democratic way out. The only thing that could avoid that would be a decision by the Supreme Court, the French Supreme Court, to overrule the law and to, you know, reset the legislative process. It has the power to do this. This is the only hope we have to avoid a major crisis.
Opinion polls show two-thirds of French people are against Macron's pension reform and the decision to push it through without a parliamentary vote. Since December, Macron has suffered a substantial drop of 8 points, and he now sees only 28% satisfied and 70% dissatisfied. Macron's government has shunned Parliament to impose the unpopular pension reforms via a special constitutional power, the so-called Article 49.3, which provides that the government can pass a bill without a vote at the National Assembly, the lower house of Parliament, after a deliberation at a cabinet meeting.
I think this was a denial of democracy. The government passed a law for which a majority of French people were against. The National Assembly was against it, using the 49.3 as a scornful of French public opinion. Macron was elected with no majority. He was elected against the Front National. We did not give him a mandate to pass these reforms, which are unjust.
Procedure has been used in the past by various governments, but this time, it's prompting a lot of criticism because of the massive public opposition to the proposed reform. The proposed changes include raising the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increasing the number of years people must make contributions to receive a full state pension. The reforms were at the heart of President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. The government insists the reform plan is essential to ensure the French pension system does not run out of money.
So yes, there aren't 100 solutions if we want the pension system to be balanced. It no longer is. And the more we wait, the more it will get worse. And so this reform is necessary. And I say this to the French people, I don't enjoy doing this, I would have preferred not to do this, but it's also because of a sense of responsibility that I express my commitment to do this in front of you.
But many see the changes, such as raising the retirement age, as unfair to people who started working young.
I'm already disadvantaged in terms of my quarterly periods, given my redundancy, given the retirement age, which is being pushed back again and again. I've had a very, very long career. I started at 15, and I feel like I'll never get there.
Last September, three explosions targeted the Nord Stream 1 and 2 natural gas pipelines. The blast rendered three of the four lines inoperable and released vast quantities of methane into the Baltic Sea. None of the four pipes are currently operational, bringing the Nord Stream project to an effective standstill. Back then, there were speculations the U.S. may have carried out the sabotage attack. Back then, former Polish Foreign Minister Radoslaw Sikorski thanked the U.S. for damaging the Nord Stream gas pipeline.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
But in February 2023, U.S. investigative journalist Seymour Hersh alleged that the blasts were carried out by the U.S. in a top-secret CIA operation ordered by President Joe Biden, with the collaboration from Norway. Hersh claimed that the U.S. Navy divers operating from a Norwegian ship using NATO's exercise in June 2022 as cover had planted mines which were later remotely detonated by a sonar bio dropped from a Norwegian plane.
They set up a committee to think of options. Russia was clearly going to go. The threat the president had yet to make had not been made. And this is December before New Year's Day of the year before, 2021. And the question inside the committee, and it included the usual CIA, NSA, Treasury Department, State Department, you name it. And they met in the secret office building in the across the street from the White House, the executive office building. The option was, do you want us to do something kinetic, or something not kinetic? In other words, not kinetic would be more sanctions, or something kinetic would be, you know, taking out the pipeline, as had been thought about.
Following Hearst's revelation, news emerged in several media outlets, including the New York Times and the German newspaper Der Zeit, that pro-Ukrainian group carried out the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines last year. But Hersh now says the CIA was instructed to come up with a cover story for the Nord Stream bombings that was fed to media outlets. Hersh says the cover-up story was created to shift blame from the U.S. Hersh says the CIA was ordered to come up with a cover story after President Biden met with the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz in Washington on March 3.
Seymour Hersh, journalist who has been covering this extensively, says this is exactly what happened, that indeed the CIA and German intelligence created this whole hogwash cover story and handed it to the media, double-spaced, you know, just exactly what they wanted you to ingest, and that the media ran with it.
Over a year has passed since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. Since the war began, the U.S. and its Western allies rushed to Ukraine's help and armed it with various types of weapons. They are now inextricably involved in the outcome of the war. In 2022, the U.S. led the way with major support decisions for Ukraine, with EU countries following suit. According to the Institute for the World Economy, adding pledges of nearly 37 billion euros in December, the Americans have earmarked a total of just over 73.1 billion euros for Ukraine's support. For the EU, the comparable figure is 54.9 billion euros. Based on estimates, the ammunition sought by Kiev could cost the bloc some 825 million euros for just 1 month. There are talks of the delivery of depleted uranium to Ukraine. Russia has already warned against such escalations. A report by the World Bank said that it will cost Ukraine $411 billion over the next 10 years to recover and rebuild from the war. Apart from Ukraine, Europe has also been forced to foot the bill. The economy of Europe is also suffering immensely. The European Union's industry chief has said the bloc will have to shift to a wartime economic model if it hopes to meet Kiev's battlefield needs. Europe's heavyweights like Germany are suffering economically. The war and the growing energy prices have cost the German economy about 2.5% of its GDP.
Faced with new and overlapping shocks, we have no choice today but to deal with uncertainty. But the public can be certain about one thing. We will deliver price stability, and bringing inflation back to 2% over the medium term is not negotiable.
While the impact is milder than expected, the country still faces a minor recession. The Biden administration is luring European companies, including German businesses. According to the German-American Chamber of Commerce, around 5,600 of them have invested in the U.S. market as of September 2022. That's an investment volume of almost $650 billion. So the question is, why is Europe risking its economic independence for the benefit of the United States and its businesses?
This was a premeditated terrorist attack on European critical infrastructure. It was also environmental terrorism. Does the EU care? Do you need to know who did it, or do you want to know? Hirsch says the US did it. Did you ask him? Did you ask him, did they do it? Or do you ask them questions anymore? Have we become so subservient? Has the EU become so subservient to US empire that you can't even ask them if they did it?
Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, has sparked yet another backlash following controversial remarks on Palestinians. The controversial minister has hit the headlines by saying that Palestinian people are an invention of the past century. Smotrich said that there was no such thing as a Palestinian because there is no such thing as the Palestinian people. He said there are no Palestinians because there are no Palestinian people. There are Arabs around who don't like it. So what do? They invent a fictitious people and claim fictitious rights to the land of Israel, only to fight the Zionist movement. Smotrich is part of veteran leader Benjamin Netanyahu's hard right cabinet that took office in December. He made those remarks during a trip to Paris, during a memorial for Jacques Kupfer, an activist for Israel's right-wing Likud party, who died in 2021. Smotrich is well known for making inflammatory statements against Palestinians. He's also a staunch opponent of the establishment of a Palestinian state. On March 1st, the racist Israeli minister sparked an international outrage by saying the Palestinian village of Hawara in the West Bank should be wiped out following a rampage by Israeli settlers. Those remarks were so repugnant that even the U.S., which is Israel's ally, criticized the statement.
In the West Bank town of Hawara, over 400 settlers, backed by Israeli soldiers, torched Palestinian homes, businesses and vehicles and killed 37-year-old Sama Aktash in what senior IDF commanders have called a pogrom. Israel's finance minister Smotrich, who describes himself as a fascist homophobe, openly said Hawara should be wiped out. Mr. Speaker, such extremism has given license by a lack of international accountability.
Controversial comments have triggered an angry response from Palestinian officials. The Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shatayeh has blasted the remarks as inflammatory. He said the Palestinian land belongs to Palestinian people and Israel is a colonial entity.
The statements made by Israeli Minister Smotrich that there is no Palestinian people and that it was invented in the last 100 years is conclusive proof of the extreme racist Zionist ideology. These inciting statements are consistent with the original Zionist narrative, a land without a people for people without a land, and that the Palestinian lands are disputed, that they are the promised land and similar such false claims. These statements, for those who wanted to eliminate dialogue expressing the arrogance of power, do not shake our belonging to our land and our history.
Farhan Haq, deputy spokesman for the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, dubbed the minister's remarks completely unhelpful, stressing the Palestinian people obviously exist. The European Union's foreign policy chief also criticized Smotrich's statement.
But I have to deplore this unacceptable comment by Minister Smotrich. It is wrong, it is disrespectful, it is dangerous, it is counterproductive to say these kinds of things in a situation which is already very tense.
It's not widely believed that such controversial comments reveal the racist nature of the Israeli regime. Meanwhile, the Tel Aviv regime sparked another backlash by implementing a controversial policy against Palestinians. The Israeli Knesset has paved the way for settlers' return to four settlements in the occupied West Bank by amending a 2005 law that ordered their evacuation. The legislative changes are particularly provocative and counterproductive to efforts to restore some measures of calm as Muslims prepare for the holy month of Ramadan. The U.S. has also said that it's, quote, extremely troubled by the controversial law. Israel is accused of imposing a system of apartheid on Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Yet it receives at least $3.8 billion of U.S. aid annually. Israel captured the West Bank, including outlets and Gaza, in 1967. Since then, it has been building settlements, housing hundreds of thousands of Israelis on the occupied lands. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law.
The United States has suffered some of its biggest bank failures since 2008. Silicon Valley Bank, the 16th largest bank in the U.S., failed after depositors hurried to withdraw money over concerns of a liquidity crisis. Officials say they acted to protect insured depositors. Regulators have taken control of the lender's deposits and transferred the assets to a newly created entity. Nearly half of the American technology and healthcare companies that went public last year after getting early funding from venture capital firms were Silicon Valley Bank customers. Moreover, a large number of startups will not be able to make payroll at some point in the next month if they cannot access their money. The lender had been under pressure lately due to fears of recession, higher interest rates, and a slowdown in the market for initial public offerings. The factors had made it harder for startups to raise additional cash. But Silicon Valley Bank was not the only U.S. financial institution to fail. Following the collapse of SVB, customers withdrew more than $10 billion U.S. dollars in deposits from New York-based Signature Bank. Regulators have now said that Signature was taken over to protect its depositors and the stability of the U.S. financial system. Signature had 40 branches, assets of $110.36 billion U.S. dollars, and deposits of $88.59 billion U.S. dollars at the end of 2022. Signature Bank was founded in 2001 as a more business-friendly alternative to the big banks. It expanded to the West Coast and then opened itself to the crypto industry in 2018.
Signature Bank is a business mostly bank with actually pretty good deposits relative to lending. And it closed mainly because I think the same thing we're seeing across the banking industry, sort of a psychology of investors losing faith in the credit quality of banking in general.
And there are a lot of red flags here. That's certainly one of them, the concentration in one industry. The explosive growth over the last year, they literally doubled in size from 100 some odd billion to over 200 billion in assets, catapulting them into one of the largest size echelon of banks in the U.S. They also had a very, as they say in the banking world and accounting, they had a very mismatched portfolio.
The bank failures have sparked fears of contagion in the financial sector, not only in the United States, but also in other countries. Bank shares in the US, Asia, and Europe have slumped following the collapse of SVB and Signature Bank. Investors have started to worry about the general state of the banking sector. Smaller US lenders were particularly hard hit. Investors are concerned that the failures are a sign of troubles at other firms. Several pension funds in the US and at least two overseas have lost millions of dollars due to the crisis. Institutions such as the California Public Employees Retirement Fund, the California State Teachers Retirement System, Korea's National Pension Service, and Sweden's Elective Pension Fund had reportedly invested in SVB. Analysts believe Silicon Valley Bank's collapse is likely to be felt across the technology landscape globally over the coming years.
But, you know, you also have the question of the impact on the financial technology and research and development, you know, venture capital industries in the United States. There's $160 billion potentially tied up in this receivership that the venture capital industry could lose.
Governments in the United Kingdom and the United States have taken extraordinary steps to stop a potential banking crisis. The UK Treasury and the Bank of England have announced that they had facilitated the sale of SVB UK to HSBC, Europe's biggest bank, ensuring the security of £6.7 billion of deposits. President Biden has also pledged stiffer bank regulations, forcing regulators to step in with a series of emergency measures.
Americans can rest assured that our banking system is safe. Your deposits are safe. Let me also assure you, we will not stop at this. We'll do whatever is needed.
The crisis has underscored the risks to banks from the end of easy money. Global borrowing costs have risen as the Federal Reserve lifted U.S. rates by 450 basis points from near zero. The European Central Bank hiked the Eurozone's by 300. There are concerns that price inflation will stay high, something that would drive further rate hikes.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The United Nations Security Council, UNSC, has expressed deep concern and dismay over the Zionist regime's settlement activity in a watered-down statement replacing a draft resolution that would have explicitly condemned the Zionist regime's policies. The council said the Security Council reiterates that continuing Israeli settlement activities are dangerously imperiling the viability of the two-state solution based on 1967 lines. The symbolic measure came in response to a decision by the Zionist regime earlier this month to authorize thousands of settlement units in the occupied West Bank and retroactively legalize unlawfully built settlement outposts. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Palestinian Wafa News Agency noted the United Nations Security Council unanimously denounced the Zionist regime's plans to expand its settlements in the occupied West Bank, stressing that the settlement activities harm the viability of the two-state solution. A statement read at the conclusion of a special meeting expressed the Council's deep concern and dismay with the Zionist regime's announcement on February 12, 2023, announcing further construction and expansion of settlements and the legitimization of settlement outposts. It added, "The Security Council reiterates that continuing Israeli settlement activities are dangerously imperiling the viability of the two-state solution based on the 1967 lines." Wafa added, read by Vanessa Fraser, Malta's UN envoy who is serving as the Council's president for the month of February, the statement said, "The Security Council strongly underscores the need for all parties to meet their international obligations and commitments, strongly opposes all unilateral measures that impede peace, including Israeli construction and expansion of settlements, confiscation of Palestinian lands, and the legitimate legalization of settlement outposts, demolition of Palestinian homes, and displacement of Palestinian civilians. The statement further condemned all acts of violence against civilians, including those that have targeted Palestinians, and called on all parties to observe calm and restraint and to refrain from proactive actions, incitement and inflammatory rhetoric with the aim, inter alia, of escalating the situation on the ground. Also, RT had an eye on this issue, writing, the United Nations Security Council, UNSC, has issued a statement denouncing Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, deeming them a major obstacle to peace in the region. While a separate resolution would have called for an immediate end to all settlement activity, it was successfully thwarted by American negotiators, according to multiple outlets. The Security Council expressed deep concern and dismay over the further expansion of settlement outposts, citing recently announced plans by the Israeli regime to legally authorize 9 existing settlements in the West Bank. The UNSC strongly opposes all unilateral measures that impede peace, including the construction and expansion of settlements, confiscation of Palestinian land, and the legalization of settlement outposts, demolition of Palestinian homes, and displacement of Palestinian civilians, it said, adding that the ongoing settlement activity is dangerously imperiling the viability of the two-state solution. RT continued, while the Israeli regime's troops withdrew from Gaza in 2005, the military continues to occupy the West Bank, often providing security for Israeli settlers, building homes and communities on Palestinian land. A long line of humanitarian organizations, as well as the UN itself, have repeatedly denounced the settlements as violations of international law, namely Article 49 of the Geneva Conventions, which states that occupying powers must not deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population into the territory it occupies. However, with hundreds of thousands of Israelis now living in the West Bank, the Zionist regime has insisted on the right to remain in the area, creating major complications for any future two-state solution. The U.S. regime has consistently supported the fabricated regime of Israel amid criticism of the settlements and other policies toward the Palestinians, frequently using its veto power at the UN to shut down resolutions seeking to condemn or curtail the Zionist regime's actions. Washington has similarly opposed efforts to seek accountability at other global bodies, such as the International Criminal Court, ICC. According to the Associated Press, the recent UN's statement was deliberately watered down following a pressure campaign by certain diplomats who reportedly led high-stakes negotiations to kill a legally binding Security Council resolution which would have required immediate action on the settlements. After heavily promoting the resolution, the Palestinian Authority ultimately agreed to suspend its efforts thanks to pressure and mediation, Axios reported. Bismillah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Here is a part of the speech delivered on March 21, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. There is one point here, and that is my discussions and demands are primarily addressed to the officials of the country, primarily the executive branch and to some extent the legislative branch and even the judiciary branch and some affiliated organizations. These discussions are primarily addressed to them. Why do I discuss these matters that are related to them in the public environment, in my public speeches with the people? The reason is that it will be good for the people to become aware of economic matters and policies in the public environment, to know about my demands, and to support and back up the officials who act on these recommendations. Of course, the people themselves have certain responsibilities. When I raise certain points about a knowledge-based economy, it will become clear that there are important tasks that the people themselves, in particular the youth, must carry out. Of course, this public discussion of matters may also help organizations to follow up matters in a better way.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What I want to say today is that for the sake of improving economic affairs of the country, we must definitely move towards a knowledge-based economy. This is the core of what I want to say today. What does a knowledge-based economy mean? It means that advanced science and technology must be able to fully play their role in all arenas of production. When I say all arenas of production, this means that we must even be able to choose the kind of production that we want. This is because it is not necessary at all to produce everything. The kind of production that we want should be based on a scientific and knowledge-based outlook. This is what a knowledge-based economy means, and it must be involved in all arenas of the economy. If we pursue this policy, if we make knowledge the basis and pillars for the economy of the country, and if we increase the number of the knowledge-based companies, later on, I will expand on this. This will bring the country and the economy many benefits. It will reduce cost. A knowledge-based economy will reduce production cost. It will increase efficiency. Today, one of our problems is that efficiency has been reduced. A knowledge-based economy will increase the quality of products and it will make products competitive. Then, in global markets, we will be able to introduce them as a competitive products. The same is true of domestic products inside the country too. When products have a better quality and are cheaper in price, the people will be drawn towards them even if we do not impose heavy tariffs on imports and even if imports flow into the country. Knowledge-based economy has such qualities.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. God's Month. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. The blessed month of Ramadan is the month of taking the lead in obedience of God and competition in doing righteous deeds. The Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Every deed has two halves. One half is worship and another half belongs to prayer." According to this luminous word, no worship is considered as a righteous deed unless it is accompanied with prayer. Prayer and asking God is the means of taking the lead in worship and servitude. The Prophet has also been narrated as saying, "Two persons enter paradise while one of them notices that the other one is superior to him. He asks God, 'My Lord, why have you given him superiority over me while our deeds were the same?' God the Exalted answers, 'He used to ask me, but you didn't. He used to pray, but you didn't.'" All of us have committed sins and have slipped from the right path. Moreover, we won't be immune from slipping in future either. But our sins shouldn't make us lose hope in God's mercy and forgiveness, no matter how great these sins are. God says in Ayah 53 of Surah Zumar, "Say that Allah declares, 'O my servants, who have committed excess against their own souls, do not despair of Allah's mercy. Indeed, Allah will forgive all sins. Indeed, He is the all-forgiving, the all-merciful.'" If a person commits sin out of ignorance and then realizes his mistake and decides to compensate and correct his behavior, God gives good news of forgiving him. The Prophet of Islam says that Allah has said, "If my servants who have turned their backs to me knew how much I wait for them and am eager to their return, they would lose life zealously." Islam has considered despairing of God's mercy as the greatest sin. How can be desperate of God's mercy while His mercy has overtaken His wrath? And the surahs of the Quran begin with the two names of Rahman, meaning the all-compassionate, and Rahim, meaning the all-merciful. These two words have been repeated nearly 450 times in the Quran. This makes us dare to turn to Allah, no matter how many sins we may have committed. Definitely, there is no refuge except God against our sins. So, how can we be disappointed of His mercy and forgiveness? However, Imam Reza, peace upon him, has warned us, saying, "He who has repented and asked his God for pardoning and forgiveness, while he is still persisting in sin and does not give up committing sin, indeed he has ridiculed himself." Those who know God are well aware that God's mercy, munificence, and magnanimity are infinite. Thus, they never quit appealing to him and demanding from him. There is no need to pass courses at the faculties of theology to recognize God. It would suffice only to look at different phenomena in nature and the world. Listening to the sound of waterfalls, the blowing of wind, and chirruping of birds will open the doors of cognizance to God, to our heart and intellect. This has been manifested in the best way in dua iftitah, or supplication of opening or starting, where the infallible Imam says, "All praise belongs to Allah, whose kingdom is clear in creation, and His praise is manifested through magnanimity of His majesty. His hand is open in munificence, the one whose treasury will never decrease, and ample giving will not increase, but His generosity and magnanimity. Indeed, He is the invincible, the all-munificent." This has been explicated by Imam Ali, peace upon him, where he says, "I haven't seen anything except that I have seen Allah with it, in it, before it, and after it." This is quite opposite of the Western surgeon who said, "I will never believe in God until I see Him lying in front of me for operation." An adamant faithless who denies God's manifest signs everywhere is like a person who denies sun and closes his eyes not to see it. In this part of the supplication, we read that the more God gives and donates, the more His generosity and magnanimity increases. To make it clear, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "Every container becomes smaller with pouring in it, except the container of knowledge, which becomes broader with pouring in it." In other words, a student who learns 10 subjects, his mind will be ready to grasp more subjects. In the same way, when God gives some bounty, the individual's capacity increases and God will give him more.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday, where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major dispute with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months, following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has in turn led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalizavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families, too, have suffered as a result. They, too, have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France. But unfortunately, the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
A sentiment echoed by other anti-apartheid campaigners here. Among them, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, who have called on the British government to refer Israel and Netanyahu to the International Court of Justice for war crimes in Palestine.
The protesters here are saying that the UK government's welcoming of Netanyahu is a mark of approval of his right-wing government, that it provides the Israeli regime with further cover to steal more Palestinian territory and to continue with its campaign of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people.
Earlier this week, the UK and Israel signed a so-called 2030 roadmap for UK-Israel relations, strengthening bilateral ties with the regime whose finance minister denies the existence of a Palestinian people.
This is an extreme right-wing government itself. So this is, you know, one proto-fascist government supporting a proper fascist government. So I don't feel that this government is ever representing me on other issues as well. But that they are supporting such an excessive, extreme right-wing government in Israel is a shame for all of us.
But while all eyes are on the intensified Israeli violence against Palestinians, others are highlighting another important reason that's dragged an embattled Netanyahu to Europe. His trip comes in the wake of the recent Chinese-brokered rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Netanyahu could be here to gauge European government's position on Iran. From London, the Israeli PM will be flying to Berlin, Germany, where he is expected to be greeted with similar protests. Said Pourreza, London.